hubbub, a chaotic din caused by a crowd of people.
Hello and welcome to season three again of our podcast series Hubbub. We are joined today by Janet Webb of Janet Webb Consulting, and we'll be talking about what the current trends are in the field of learning and development. So welcome, Janet, to
Thank
the
you.
Hub.
Nice to be here.
Great to see you here, Janet.
So I didn't introduce you.
No, you didn't.
I'm so bad. Okay. Joining me as my co-host is the very wonderful and delightful.
Yeah, dig yourself out of the hole.
Yeah, I am trying to. Faye Miller of Gingerbread World, who will be joining me on this podcast today. Sorry, I forgot you.
That's all right, I'll let you off. Anyway, it's lovely to see you, Janet, here, and to chat a bit about your business, J-Web Consulting, and how you got into it, how it began, and how your career started, really. So I thought we would start right back at the beginning. Uh-huh. Tell us a bit about, well, first of all, tell us what J-Web Consulting does, and then we'll go from there.
So one of those things where I know exactly what I do, but it's quite difficult to describe it. But essentially what I do is help people be better at their jobs by helping them understand how their brains work, how their emotions impact on their behaviour, where their emotions come from. So an easy way of describing what I do is help people develop management skills, develop presentation skills, develop good customer service. But my niche, I suppose, is really getting them to understand why people behave the way that they behave, why they behave themselves that way, and why other people behave. And therefore, if we understand that, really get that, then we have choices about what we do.
So you must have a lot of interest in that behavioural aspect.
Absolutely.
Because it does drive a lot of things. You know, it's like telling people to go on a diet, for example, when they know that they should do, but they don't do it, and it boils down to behaviour all the time. So I guess it must be the same in business as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I got into it because I was working at Selfridges and I'd got moved into the training team, and I had this moment of revelation where I was struggling to communicate with people because I was intimidated by my colleagues and various other things. And they gave me some hard feedback that sometimes I could be quite aggressive.
Right.
And actually what they were talking about really was me making faces and being manipulative when I wanted to say I'm really upset but didn't know how to do that.
Right.
And that revelation that I was doing that, and then, I mean, we're talking in the early 90s here, that understanding that I was doing something and then learning about that and exploring that just opened up a whole different world for me. And now I've spent the last 30 years helping other people get that same understanding.
Wonderful. So how did you get into that in the first place? You said you were at Selfridges.
Yeah.
What were you actually doing at Selfridges?
Well, so I had, I'd spent 3 years travelling abroad, yeah, as a professional dancer, actually. And I got back to London and I just needed a job. And
yeah,
I was told that Selfridges were taking on Christmas staff. I walked in, I left half an hour later with a 3-month contract to work in the Christmas greeting card department in Selfridges.
Nice.
And I left 7 years later, having worked through the store, having been developed as a manager in the store, and literally working up the building because,
yeah,
the training team was on the top floor, and then moving into training. So first just doing, you know,
yeah,
how to use a till and that sort of stuff.
So how did you, so you said you were a professional dancer. Mm. So when you came, so that must have been quite fun travelling around for 3 years,
yeah,
was it? Or was it hard work or a bit of both?
It was, parts of it were the best experiences of my life and parts of it were the worst experiences of my,
okay,
life. And sometimes simultaneously.
Yeah. what sort of things were the best and the worst then?
Being in foreign countries and learning about new cultures.
Yeah.
So I worked in a number of countries in Europe. I worked in Aden in South Yemen before that sort of got amalgamated into one country again. That was an extraordinary experience. I then had 4 months in Cairo, where I was supposed to have been there for a year, but I got hepatitis. So that went from being my ideal job to being really very seriously ill and experiencing awful management. and have it and been literally being locked in a room for 2 weeks waiting for an exit visa to go home. Wow. It was just one of the most depressing moments of my life.
Wow. So you were really ill and they just locked you in a room,
the
hospital
much.
Treatment. So you were coming back here to get treatment, were you?
Yeah. Yeah. So I was ill. I worked for a couple of days being really, really ill.
Yeah.
And then one of my colleagues dragged me off to a doctor and they realised what was wrong with me. And the hotel management literally said to me, "You are an embarrassment to us." I lost the. I had a nice room, which was a big Ouch. Double room with an ensuite and all the rest of it. And they stuck me in a room that was just about big enough with a bed. And I had no money and I was stuck there waiting for an exit visa.
Gosh.
And nobody cared. Not a single person. No, that's nobody who should have cared, cared.
Yeah.
There was one person who was living in the hotel who I'd befriended, and he paid the chef to make me food and bring it
wow.
up to me.
God, that is insane, that attitude. It's just that you were ill, which is through no fault of your own,
yeah.
you know, and that they're blaming you for it.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the likelihood is I got it in the hotel. That's yeah. the most ridiculous thing. That's why they were so embarrassed by it.
They didn't want to deal with the problem.
No,
it's easier to do that, isn't it? It's a horrendous experience.
It was an awful experience. The guy in question was Belgian. I want to be very clear that he wasn't an Egyptian. And he, you know, he just... To look someone in the face that's that ill and say, "You are an embarrassment," is just
that
extraordinary.
Is incredible.
Yeah.
I can't get over that,
no.
I suppose.
There we go.
You came back to the UK, and then did you still work as a dancer then, or was that the point that you then went to Selfridges?
No, so I came back to the UK. It took a good 6 months to get over that experience,
yeah.
Physically get over it
yeah.
and emotionally. And then I signed up with another company because I was working for a French company in
yeah.
Cairo, and they... also just completely abandoned me.
Blimey.
So I was then working for a different company, and I spent a year and a half in Greece, which was just wonderful. But came back to England and thought, right, time to actually do something different. I can't spend the rest of my life travelling.
So did you think about going to something, doing dancing in the UK, or was that like, I need to do something else now? Or
The issue for me was, so when I was very little, I wanted to do, if you'd asked me at the age of 6 what I wanted to do when I grew up,
yeah.
I would have said that I wanted to be a professional dancer. I wanted to be a ballet dancer.
Yeah.
And the reality is I still want to be a ballet dancer when I grow up. You know, I shall
yeah.
be 59 in a couple of months' time. And what I didn't realise at that point was actually that was a real driver for me. But we didn't have the money for me to do that as a child. And so at 15, I'd got a job in a little ironmonger's store on a Saturday morning. And I used that money to get some dancing lessons for myself. So I spent 3 years learning to dance
yeah.
properly. And then travelled for 3 years.
Yeah.
But what I didn't have really was the technical ability to be able to compete against other
right, okay.
dancers in
yeah.
the UK. I would have loved to have, you know,
yeah.
Cats was the big thing at the time, and
yeah.
I would have loved to have been in that. But
yeah.
I was never going to do that. So I had to go and do something else.
So you did Selfridges and you worked your way up,
mm-hmm.
and then you got this feedback from
yes.
them. So how was it getting that feedback? Was that like an epiphany, that moment when you, or was it, because you said it was quite a harsh feedback.
It was, yeah.
yeah.
We were doing a particular exercise and we got sort of feedback from each other, and we were giving
yeah.
feedback to each other. And I literally had a piece of paper which said that every single one of my colleagues had ticked me as being aggressive. And of course my response was, "What the blazes do you mean I'm aggressive?" You know, I handled it really well. And I looked at 7 people who all looked at me absolutely terrified. And I thought, this has got to change. What
yeah.
is this about?
Yeah.
So I went and studied with a lady called Dr. Joanna Bisdee, who was just a most extraordinary woman, absolutely fabulous, and learnt about the psychology of why we behave in the way that
yeah.
we behave. And that has absolutely changed my life.
So that was kind of the pivotal moment that led you on this path
yeah.
to, you know, working and
yeah.
you know, helping leadership and so on.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So after you worked with her, then did you work for other people? Or did you set up your own consulting?
I was still working at Selfridges, and then, but by that point, I had moved down to the South Coast, back home essentially, and was was commuting up to London for 3 years, and I'd had enough of the commute.
Yeah.
So I got a job working at St Richard's in Chichester, delivering anything that wasn't clinical training, really. Yeah. So there was lots of people in the hospital delivering all sorts of different clinical training, but there was a need for someone to do assertiveness training and recruitment training and, you know, diversity and inclusion training. It wasn't called that then, but that's what it was. And so that was my job. I did that for a few years. And then I had my children and took a space to spend some time with my children. Then went into East Sussex County Council.
Yeah.
And at one point, I was HR manager looking after people who were delivering HR projects.
Right.
And that was a really interesting time in my life.
Yeah.
Because it happened around the time of the big financial crash. And I could see that we were going to have to make people redundant.
Yeah.
And I was going to be one of them, really. And in fact, that was absolutely the case. I was going to be made redundant in March 2011, at the end of March. And on the 20th of March, there was a call for anybody that could look after the registration service for 3 months because the manager was on long-term sick. And I said, well, I can do that. I knew nothing about the registration service, but I said, I could do that. And I did that. And in fact, I did that for 6 months. And then I was due to go. And my manager at the time went, oh, hang on a minute. And she dashed out of the office and came back in and gave me another project to do. And at the end of that, she found me another project to do. And at the end of that, she found me another project to do. So I had about just over a year of doing really diverse projects, doing all sorts of things.
So instead of being made redundant, you were sort of going...
In fact, I broke the system. They had an IT system that managed people who were on, you know, signed to be made redundant and the jobs would come through that were available to them. And I broke the system twice because it wasn't designed to have somebody on it for...
Computer says no.
Yes, yeah, essentially 18 months in the end of me being in the mix for that. But it was a brilliant experience for me because it meant that it built my confidence that I could do anything and pick up anything and actually really hone the skill of moving into a new environment and knowing very quickly which way's up.
Really. Yeah. So at that point, after that point, did you eventually leave or get made redundant? And
Was going to offer me another contract and I went, enough now. I had, at that point, 10 letters from HR telling me that this was my new leaving date and I would not receive any more letters.
Okay.
And I got 10 of them saying that. And I got to the stage where I said, I need to either give me a contract doing projects for the rest of my life, which is great, or let me go.
Yeah.
And we agreed that I would actually be made redundant. So I was made redundant at the end of July, and then in September I set up Janet Webb Consulting.
Had you already been thinking about setting up Janet Webb Consulting, or was it something you sort of got made redundant and thought, what should I do now? And
I had thought about it. So I was at home with my kids and thinking, what am I going to do next, you know? And my husband got a job down in Bournemouth. And the plan was that we would all move down to Bournemouth and I would set up my business down there. So I had been thinking about that, but the job in Bournemouth didn't pan out for various reasons. So after a year, he came back and we hadn't been able to sell our house because of all the financial chaos at the time. So I just needed any job, and that's when I went into East Sussex County Council. So when I was back to that, okay, what am I going to do now? That was the moment I thought, do you know what? This is the time to go freelance. And lots of people said to me, yep, do it.
Yeah.
Go freelance. We've got work for you. Go and do it.
Oh, brilliant.
As it actually panned out, it took a while for that work to come through, but it did in the end.
It did in the end. So I've got one question going back to the Selfridges thing. After you, obviously the feedback you received being that sort of pivotal moment that set you on this path, did you ever get better feedback after that with Selfridges.
Well, yes, because what we had done an exercise called Belbin. And through that exercise, what you have to do is you get a whole load of words for each of your colleagues and you tick the ones that you think apply to them. And we did it again about a year later, maybe 18 months, something like that. And nobody had said I was aggressive at that point. And it had fundamentally changed my behaviour, yeah. Fundamentally changed my personality, yeah. Actually. And it was sort of, yeah, we acknowledge that, yeah. You took that feedback, you did something about it, and actually,
yeah,
you've moved on.
And I guess that, in essence, is what you do in your business now, isn't it? Sort of helping people, giving them feedback, and then helping them to tell me a bit more about how you help people, help managers, for example.
Well, the whole thing about being aggressive or passive or manipulative or any of those things is fundamentally about fear.
Yeah.
You know, we struggle just to say in a straightforward way what it is we want. So we either get so wound up that we get aggressive, or we do it in a really sneaky, quiet way. And so understanding that fear has this enormous impact on the way we behave is key to that. But also, it's key to if you're doing a presentation. We get people who struggle to give a presentation. Mm. Do so because of the impact of fear. And so, yes, for me, it was about communicating in an effective and straightforward way. But that lesson of understanding how our emotions are impacting on our behaviour, that gets taken through everything that I do now. Yeah. So I work with people, I work with a lot of people who want to be able to do a good presentation, and they can put it all together fine, but as soon as they're stood there in front of an audience, they go to pieces.
Everything goes out of
their
head.
And helping them get that and understand that just opens up things for them.
Yeah. So do you get companies sending you... How does it work? I mean, do you get companies sending you, going, we've got this manager, you know, she's fucking aggressive. Can you help us? Or we're going to have to bin her.
Tends not to be like that.
Yeah.
So sometimes it can be specific, you know, a call out for we need a trainer to come and help us with customer service, or we need a trainer to come and help us with new managers. We've got a whole load of new managers and we need to give them some skills.
Right.
So it's not just about our emotions and the impact of that, but it can be other things. You know, how do you manage your time? How do you give feedback to other people effectively? How do you goal set, and how do we do that? So it's a whole load of skills and knowledge that I bring to whatever that is. But occasionally it can be we've got a new manager and they're really struggling. Can you help them? So typically an organisation will find a coach for them, which is great. But actually sometimes people need some training with that. And I'm not a trained coach, but I am a that's not strictly true, but anyway, we'll gloss over that. I do have some coaching skills, but what I do with people more is just help them deal with whatever it is by taking them through some training, some personal assessment, probably, maybe some exercises to help them think about what's going on.
Yeah.
When I was working as the training manager at St. Richard's, every week someone would come to my door and say, Janet, have you got 10 minutes? Can you just find me a course on this? Mm. And I'd say, take a seat. And an hour later they'd left and I'd help them sort out what that was.
Yeah.
It was often, I've got this member of staff that's a bit difficult and I don't know how to deal with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, an hour and a half later they'd go out with some strategies for dealing with that.
Yeah.
And that was a long time ago, actually. But it I remember talking to a colleague of mine and saying, do you know what? I think that's the best work I do. Mm. And she said, then just do that. You know? Which is fine. And I would just work one-to-one with people if I could.
Yeah.
That's not where the money is.
No.
And working, and I actually really like being in a big room with eight people and working through a problem together, looking at creativity or problem solving or whatever it is. So that's how I work.
Do you find it very rewarding when you can see, do you get to see the sort of the changes as they're, you know, the behavioural changes as they're implemented, even if it's not necessarily a conscious thing all the time with people, but the way they interact and the way the business functions, for example.
It depends what it is, whether you see it immediately or whether you see it over time. But I love being in a room with people where you've opened up a perspective on something, you know, and the look on their faces where they realise how that affects them, how they can use that, how that's going to impact on their working lives. And suddenly they're like, I now have a solution to a problem that I've been struggling with for 6 months, 3 years, 20 years, whatever it is. And that feeling of seeing that, you know, that seeing that expression in their face is just the best thing ever. The best time I ever had that was I was working with a group of higher level teaching assistants. And these were, they all happened to be women. They were women working in schools with special educational needs children. And they had got into that school in the first place because their own child had special educational needs. And so they were experts in whatever it was they were helping with. Whether that was dyslexia or whether that was autism or whatever it was. They absolutely knew more about that subject than any other person in the school. But many of these women had never worked in any other job. They'd just done this.
Right.
And so they were being asked to deliver presentations on this aspect. And I was called in to help them just get over the sheer fear of that, but also help them, you know, how do you put a presentation together and all the rest of it. And in the morning, this one lady came in to this one day that I was running with them. And she said, you'll never get me to do this. I stood on a stage 3 years ago in front of a group of head teachers and I just went to pieces and you will never get me to do this. And by the end of the day, she looked at me, she said, I can't wait. And that was the best feeling ever to see that I'd given her a gift. It was her gift.
Yeah.
How she ran with it now was absolutely up to her. But she now had choices on how she managed her nerves, and therefore she could go and tell her story and give her knowledge to that group of people who were hungry for it.
Yeah,
what a wonderful accolade.
It was just wonderful. It was such a good feeling.
That must be, it must be that point where you go, yes, what I'm doing is really worthwhile, and, I can really, really see I'm making the difference and stuff.
Yeah. And it's about that particular episode made me realise that what I do is make ripples, because I had changed something in her, which meant that she could now go and communicate her knowledge to a group of people who could then therefore interact better with the children that they were dealing with. And so it rippled and rippled and rippled and rippled.
So, I mean, the topic for this podcast today is, what are the trends in the field of learning and development? So how has it changed since you've been running your consultancy? What sort of things, is there more focus and more emphasis on, you know, behavioural patterns and how people behave with each other in the office? I'm assuming here, but tell me if I'm wrong, that has changed. There is more emphasis on that sort of thing now.
Well, there's a number of things that have changed, really. So when I first went into training and development, every single big organisation will have a list of training courses that get published to all of their employees, and you pick the one that you want to go on and that sort of thing. And that's quite rare now for that to happen.
Right.
It's much more responsive to what's going on. It's much more, okay, we can see strategically that we need this, therefore let's find someone that can help deliver that. And it might be a training course, but more often it's more of a program of events and resources and those sorts of things, and helping people learn on the job. COVID has had a simultaneously fabulous and disastrous effect on training and development. So what happened when COVID hit and everybody had to put everything online, what tended to happen was that people took their classroom-based training programs and just forced that into Zoom or Teams or whatever it was, which it was understandable, but actually not very effective. What has come out of that is that we now have an ability, because actually when you stick someone on a one-day training course or a whole week's training course where it's back-to-back, actually we don't learn very well like that. We learn much better in short bits, and we learn best and can apply it best when we're learning it at the point where we need it. Yeah. So sending someone on a training course to learn how to use Excel, for instance, is fine. But if they don't use that for 6 months, then all of that learning has gone
out the window. Yeah.
So the move for learning and development really is to give stuff sort of just in time and at the point of need, to offer people a package of resources that they can tap into when they need it.
Right.
The other thing that is really impacting on learning and development at the moment, and HR in general really, is the advent of AI. And again, we can see some fabulous stuff coming out and some really terrible stuff coming out. So some of the most important thing for us to understand is how AI is going to impact on the world of work. I heard Professor Daniel Susskind talking about, he's an economist, and he was talking about how technology in the past changed working lives for manual workers, blue-collar workers. But AI now is changing working lives for white-collar workers, you know, and changing work for solicitors and medical consultants and everybody who in the past would have been protected from that, but now suddenly their jobs are changing. You know, we've got AI diagnosing more effectively than people with 30 years' experience can. And his call was not that we should throw our hands up in horror and say, well, nobody's going to work, but to understand that what the human brings is empathy and creativity and innovation, and that's where we need to focus our training in the future, is to make sure people will be able to use AI effectively, but will be flexible and agile in the way that they do that.
Yeah.
The World Economic Forum came up with a list of the skills that people were going to need over the next sort of 5 years or so. And top of that list was agility and flexibility. COVID really taught us, actually, we need to change. We need to be able to change like that. Yeah. And organisations did. You know, banks, who if you'd said to them, right, you're going to have all your staff working from home, that would have been a five-year project, with a whole load of consultants coming to tell you how to do it, and IT with, pulling their hair out, and all the legal experts, concerns about this, that, and the other. And there they were at the beginning of 2020, and within weeks they had done it. Because they had to.
They had to. No choice, did they?
No choice.
And so many organisations, when COVID hit, had to fundamentally, I've used fundamentally about five times now. You can count them later, Sonny. They have to change, the way they work. And that's not, COVID hasn't gone away. There's another global pandemic around the corner. We're in the middle of two wars going on, major wars going on at the moment. The world is a place that's changing and changing at pace. And technology is changing at pace.
Yes.
We are at a moment in time where anything could happen now. And actually, so therefore, the skills that people need for organisations to be really effective is this creativity and flexibility and innovation and those kinds of skills. So learning and development really has to grasp that nettle of helping organisations do that, but also helping them to do that at the point of need, in the workplace, in a social way. I said earlier that the moving everything online was brilliant and disastrous. In some way, moving all your training online pulls away a very important part of learning, and that is learning together, social learning. It's how we learn. You learn a piece of technology or a skill or something. You think about when you learnt to drive. For the first few lessons, your instructor is telling you what to do next. Do this next, do this next. But it soon gets to a point where he or she is saying to you, well, what are you thinking about now? What do you think you need to do? And you're driving along and saying, oh, I'm not sure how I do this. What do I do now? That's the social element, and we must not lose that.
Do you think there's a risk that we are losing it a bit? Because, I mean, I've I think there has been a move back towards, like when you see jobs, they're a lot more hybrid now as opposed to fully remote, and the move back into the office. But do you think there is still a risk that it will go more towards, because it's easier, people can sit in their own homes and learn rather than having to get on a train and commute to London, as you say?
Risk is an interesting word. I think it's evolving.
Yeah.
I think we will get to a stage where most training courses will look very different from what they looked like 5-10 years ago.
So they won't be sending someone off for a week to go and learn, I don't know, management skills, for example. They'll be doing it in the office and alongside their actual role.
Yeah, and I think there'll be a lot more kind of, all right, we're going to put a cohort together because actually we need that social element. We'll get them together so that they get to learn each other, and then we'll do lots of bits of learning over a period of time. Some of that will be online. Some of that will be resources that we've put together that can self-select when they need that.
Yeah.
We might get them back together again at various points through that program so that they can have that, you know, chatting it through, chewing it through with other people. We mustn't lose that.
Yeah.
But we also mustn't lose the great stuff about online, which means that you can do it when you need to. You can do it in bite-sized chunks, which is the much more effective way of learning.
Yeah.
I think it's brilliant. It's so important. And you are right, Janet. It's a massively important time. And we do shut down. People are daunted by the future.
Yes.
And so having facilitators like yourself in place to help train support people is massively beneficial.
I think my HR colleagues, and particularly the people working in employment law, have got quite a headache on their hands at the moment in terms of getting this right. Some organisations are saying, no, you've all got to come back into the office, and they're finding it difficult to recruit. Some are saying, look, do whatever you want, just keep in touch. And they're finding that the learning is being lost between people. You know, when you're in an office with a whole load of other people and you don't know how to do X, Y, and Z, you ask Nelly, don't you? You're sat next to Nelly and you ask Nelly and Nelly tells you how to do it. That stuff's important. And being social is really important. Even being online, the one thing that you cannot do when you're on Zoom or Teams is look somebody in the eyes.
No. Because it's just weird, and you're losing out on that, well, the water cooler chats, aren't you, as it were. You know, you're standing in the kitchen, have a quick coffee break or whatever, and you just chat about stuff, might be work, whatever, but you're losing that social interaction because it's just not the same over Zoom, and then you're constantly as you're waiting for them to talk, and they're waiting for you to talk, and it's just bloody awkward at times.
It is, but forcing people into a way of working to try and capture that water cooler moment, that's not right either. And I think it will take time. We also have a group of people coming into the workplace now who have just gone through a few years of sheer hell.
Yeah.
And they've had to, you know, go through a schooling where they had to be at home and were stuck at home, perhaps with a parent or two parents who were struggling because they were trying to work at the same time as make their child do some homework or whatever. And they're going into a workplace now where they don't know how to speak to somebody on the phone because they never do. They text and use social media.
Yeah, my kids are terrified of picking up the phone and calling people because they're just not used to it.
No, absolutely.
They really don't. They find it absolutely petrifying at times.
And so that whole social part of their life, you know, which should have been the best part of their life, you know, their teenage years where you mucked around with your mates at school, that was interrupted, and that's going to have a long-term impact as well, I think.
It's interesting. It's having an impact. The other thing that I was talking to someone who's a manager up at Gatwick, I can't remember what he does, but anyway, cool stuff with their website, whatever. But he was saying that he's having to do training now on how to deal with, like, they've got, for the first time ever, they've got four generations in the office because you've got people in their 50s and 60s, mm-hmm. and you've got people in their 40s and their 30s, and then you've got, like, the Gen Zers in their early 20s coming up now, and their needs and the way they work are very different, and it's not one size fits all. It's very, and that's taking a bit of getting used to for him to deal, because like the people in their 40s and 50s are perhaps more deferential. They, you know, look up to management, whereas the people in the 20s expect their manager to be more of a mentor, and they expect more from the, I want to work this way,
yep.
and they'll tell them how they want to work, whereas the people of our age will kind of like just accept it as it is. And it must be very difficult to try and manage those different behaviours and expectations and different categories.
But if you get that right, how fabulous is that? How brilliant is it that you've got four generations working together and they can learn from each other? It's getting the older generations to understand that they've got so much to learn from the younger generations and vice versa.
Do you think that's the sticking point sometimes, that the older generations are like, well, I'm not learning from these young whippersnappers. What are they going to teach me? And, you know, the old, the younger ones going, well, we don't want to learn from these old bastards who are dinosaurs. So...
I think different people will behave differently in different circumstances.
Some people be more willing than
others,
I
think.
I guess.
Some of the older generation are just going to say, how exciting is this? You know, it had never occurred to me to say to my boss, actually, I'd prefer to do this way.
Yeah.
Wow, that's opened up different perspectives for me. It depends, doesn't it? Some people are crap at every age.
I suppose it does depend on people. I mean, I've met a huge amount of people over the years, and whether it's networking or in business. And recently I went to an office, and the manager was, I think he was 22 or 23, and most of the staff working for him were my age, like 50-odd.
Mm.
And he found it an uphill struggle to actually tell them what to do and how to support them.
Yeah.
And he had to go on a management training course to learn how to deal with the older generation, because they had a different ethos.
Yeah.
So it must be difficult at times, quite daunting.
Yeah, but again, it's back to understanding what makes people tick and understanding why they're behaving in the way that they're behaving. So I've got a friend, Sue, who's a mediator, and she says that pretty much all mediation is sorted out if you can get both sides to see it from the other person's perspective. And, you know, if you're 60 and your manager is 22, I can see that might feel uncomfortable. The onus is on both of them to understand it from the other person's perspective. Now, that's where I can come in, because I can help that 22-year-old, you know, have the confidence to turn around and say, yeah, I value all your experience, but I am your manager and this sits with me and the buck is stopping with me at the moment, and this is what we need to do. How are we going to do it together? And getting people to understand. To me, good management is helping the people that are working with you understand exactly what it is the outcome needs to look like, giving them the freedom to do it how they want within the parameters that you've got, like budgets and time and that sort of thing. Make sure that they have the resources that they need and get out their way. You know, if you can get those four elements right, then people will move mountains for you.
Yeah, I suppose that's the thing. If you micromanage people too much, then it has the opposite effect.
Micromanagement is just insecurity and fear.
Yeah.
That's, again, you see, it comes back to that.
It comes back to fear.
It absolutely comes back to fear.
It's interesting, actually, because I was reading Diary of a CEO by Stephen Bartlett, and he was talking about Sir Alex Ferguson and Manchester United and how that was one of their most successful periods as a football team, and about Sir Alex's management style, if you like. And I don't give two shits about football, if I'm honest, but it was really interesting about how Sir Alex dealt with the different players in his team, and he dealt with them all very, very differently and played to their strengths and understood the behaviours of each one and how each one would react to things that he would say or do. So some he might shout out and chew them out because that would be the best way to get them to respond, and others he would sort of almost be like a fatherly figure and he wasn't interested in tactics. Everybody thought he was a great tactician, but he wasn't really interested in that. What he was interested in was getting the players to perform at their optimal best by understanding the way they behaved.
Absolutely.
Basically,
your job as a manager is to help people thrive, and what is it they need in order to be able to thrive? I wouldn't advocate shouting it. But I get it, you know, and they respected him. You can't shout at someone and expect them to do what you want unless they respect you, unless they understand why you're shouting at them. It wouldn't be my number one technique,
I
get it.
It's a bit of an archaic technique, perhaps, but I'm sure for certain characters, perhaps it does work.
Yeah.
Mind you, I mean, going back to my early days as a journalist, we the atmosphere was quite toxic in the newsroom, but we were not ever praised. We were only called into the editor's office and shouted out if we'd done something wrong, which wasn't very inspiring, basically.
No. Yeah. And we could do a whole podcast on praising people and giving people feedback. One of the things that we get wrong is when we're giving people feedback, we say, right, you've done this wrong and you've done this wrong and you've done this wrong and you've done this wrong. But other than that, you're doing fine.
Yeah.
And what we're doing there is summing up 90% of their working life under the word fine. Yeah. And the problem with fine is I don't know how to reproduce that. Yeah. I don't know what you mean by fine.
Yeah, it's not quantifiable.
No, absolutely. So we need to be really good at giving good feedback about what people do well. Then they can reproduce that.
Yeah.
It's brilliant, isn't it? I mean, the psychology of your role is quite fascinating.
I'm doing this at the best time ever, because over the last 10 years or so, maybe longer, the neuroscience that has come out that has said not only do we know from a psychological perspective what's going on, but actually we can track that. We can see that happening. We know what's happening in people's brains in terms of the chemicals flooding in the brain and what impact that has on people. So the learning that we've got over the last 10 years, as I say, on how we can work more effectively, how we can make our brains work more effectively, it's just perfect for me, really, because I'm fascinated by this stuff. I've been fascinated by this stuff since I was about 5. And here I am at the best time to be doing it. Love it. Yeah.
So Selfridges to professional dancer to trainer.
Yes, that's me.
So what about in your personal life? Can you use your behavioural techniques to get your kids to do what you want?
Oh, no, it absolutely fails with children. It completely fails with children, which is very sad, really. And the problem with my kids is that they know if I'm trying to do a technique on them, they just like...
They can spot it.
Yeah, no,
see
it's
straight
not,
through you.
Absolutely not going to work on me, Mum, so... that's fine.
Damn, I was hoping for some advice.
No, sorry. Really, really, you can't. You can help your children get to sort of teenage years, but at that point they realise you don't know everything, and that's the point in their life
where they think you don't know anything.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, they're trying to stretch their boundaries and do their own stuff, and at that point you've got no hope in trying to mould them. All you can do is be a good role model for them, I think.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, we're all parents, so...
Disaster. If you can get to them to adulthood and they still like you, then I think you're doing quite well, really.
Yeah. Well, I think they go through a stage of hating you and then they start to like you again when they realise that maybe they don't know anything, everything, and maybe their parents do actually know more than...
Yeah.
Or at least something, I suppose.
Yeah. So.
Well, we've got a few questions for you, Janet.
All right.
I know you sort of had some thoughts on them, but what's the one thing your business venture did that you didn't expect?
I didn't expect it to change as much. Yeah. So, at the beginning, I expected it to be me delivering training courses to people, and it hasn't really been like that, and I'm glad it hasn't really been like that. But this is also something that I've learned from other people. When you go into business, you think you're going to do X, Y, and Z. Don't be surprised if by year 3 you're doing A, B, and C with a bit of Z, and you're not doing X at all anymore. You think you know what you're going to offer, but that's likely to change, and it did. It changed for me, and for the better, really. So don't be fixed in what you've got to be flexible about that, I think.
Interesting. We're slowly running out of time. I've just been given the nod that we have a few minutes left.
Okay.
So I'm going to ask you this question, just to maybe finish on.
Okay.
It's kind of a personal question that you've highlighted. So.
Oh, gosh, have I?
You have. But
you may come to regret this.
Yes.
What's your favourite childhood memory?
Now, there's interesting. As a child growing up, I was into being on the stage, and I was part of the Worthing Gang Show from very early age. In fact, I was part of the Worthing Gang Show 2 years before I should have technically been. But that's a story for another time. And that being on stage, presenting managing nerves, you know, we're talking a long time of thinking about this sort of stuff, but being part of a team, working together, that was just such a very, very happy time in my life. And my family were all involved with that, and so that was an important part of it for me, but also just being part of something brilliant, 100 kids on stage, all working together to deliver something brilliant was great.
Yeah. It sounds brilliant because that facilitation of the trainer has started off at a very early age.
Yes.
to push you on that path.
Well, I will just say this. When I was five, and this is all part and parcel of how my brain works. When I was five, I saw a TV programme, and in that, there was a moment where somebody realised... somebody was really angry with another person because they hadn't done something. But we as an audience understood why they hadn't done that. And so at the age of five, that realisation that you need the big picture to really understand things, even at that age, that was an understanding for me that's carried me through my whole life. Wisdom is about understanding that we don't know everything.
I might hold that as a quote at the end of the year from the Director's Hub Christmas event. Who said this and when?
Yeah.
So we're coming towards the end of the podcast, and it's time to say adieu. Or
adieu
goodbye.
To you too.
Thank you very much for joining us, Janet. It's been a very insightful topic, and apologies that I had to disappear earlier. My twin seems to have given me a cold again. They've gone to plague school and I have another cold, so I do apologise.
That's fine.
And Faye, do you have any final comments?
It's been great chatting to you and learning a bit about behavioural change and that kind of thing. It's interesting how I don't really think about it so much, but now it's given me certainly a lot of food for thought.
You'll notice things and you'll think, there we go.
Yeah, I notice when I'm being, you know, a bit cross with my partner and stuff
when we're avoiding something.
Yeah,
that's often telling us that, you know, we're thinking about something in a way that's probably not very helpful.
Yeah. No, it's been brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Thank you very much. See you soon.
Hubbub, the Director's Hub podcast, sponsored by the Sussex Business Show.